Bottom of the cellar steps was an iron door.
Here, wait in here, my lord. The noble lady will see you shortly.
And the young man went in?
When hell freezes over!
Vasily spent the next few hours hunting for a way to escape. His only companion was the skeleton of a former inmate left there to die. He tried to force the door, but it was cold iron. There was no window, and the cell was lined with mortared stone.
Damn!
He was hungry now. He opened his pack and took food from it, eating it but sparingly. He was of the people, and he could see in full darkness because he hadn't ruined his eyes with television.
Grandpa, my eyes are fine.
Okay, so can you blame an old man for being concerned? So your eyes are good too, that's good. His eyes were better. He drank the water in his pack, measuring it out a mouthful at a time. Eventually, there was no food or water left. We of the people are hard to kill. And harder to kill the older we get. But he was young, and without food or water or moonlight, he would die the true death. A slow death, and far from noble. Vasily resigned himself to his passing. He sat in his cell, under earth, under stone, guarded by cold, cold iron. And he waited, hungry, thirsty, and weak for the end. At first, he thought he was imagining the light. But it grew and grew, and holding it, suddenly appeared the tall, thin librarian he had met twice before.
Hello, young man. I've come for my book.
If you had waited another week, then you would not have to ask. You could simply have taken it from my corpse.
It's not that simple. At this point, the book is your property. When you die, technically it becomes the property of the Duke. And I really have no desire to open negotiations with the Duke. It would almost certainly attract attention, which is something I'm doing my best to avoid. Goodness knows what my lord would say if he learned I'd let a book be stolen from his library. Do you know how long it's been since I mislaid a book?
No.
Well, let's just say the continents weren't in their current shapes. Not that that means anything to you.
No.
So, suppose we do a deal. Your freedom for the book. Yes?
No.
No?
I am of the people, man. What I seek, I find. What I hunt, I take. I can hide in a shadow. My teeth are sharp enough to cut bone. I run on four legs as easily as two. I am kin to Duaro and Night Gaunt. I owe allegiance to none born, and I fear nothing! I want a woman!
Oh dear. Well, you'd better come with me then.
He followed the thin man through a door that hadn't been there a moment before, and found himself in the library. It seemed to go on forever. A beautiful hallway, lined with books in every direction.
Where are we?
Shh! Now quiet through here. Very, very quiet. I can take shortcuts, but only through the library. We mustn't do anything to attract his attention. Be very, very quiet.
Lucien?
Ah!
You did not tell me we had a guest? Stop that. Well, Lucien, I'm waiting.
Ah, well, Lord, I must admit, I was hoping that you wouldn't find out about this.
Your newfound habit of bringing home strays?
No, not exactly. Oh, these spectacles.
Do Lucian.
There is a book missing from the library, Lord. It is in the possession of this young man. But everything's all right. I've sorted it all out, and he's going to give it back to us for an price.
I see. And what is his price?
So the young man showed him the miniature in the locket, and the Lord of Dreams listened to his tale. And then he smiled.
I see. Give Lucian the book.
Here.
Lucian?
Yes, this is the one. The Merry Comedy of the Redemption of Dr. Faustus by Marlowe.
Very good. Now, let us visit your lady friend.
One step forward, and they were in the bedroom of the Duke's youngest daughter, whose name was... I don't remember. Natasha? Something like that. She was asleep in her bed. She lay unclothed under a cover of furs and was even more beautiful than the miniature.
She dreams of walking through a covered market, looking for cornflowers and finding only goblets of sour blood. Well, do you dare wake her up?
Vasily touched the woman's shoulder, and she opened her eyes.
Hello. What? What are you doing in my chamber? Who are you? Who are these people?
Vasily looked at her. She was beautiful indeed, and pale, and fragile. She was everything he had dreamed of. He took off the locket and put it in her hand.
This is yours.
Oh.
And now?
I'm hungry. Take me away from here, please.
The Lord of Dreams took the young man back to his palace, and Vasily feasted there on venison and hare and pheasant and kid. He drank Tokay and sherbet and fine brandy. When Lucian asked Vasily about the Duke's daughter, he shook his head and said nothing. But the Lord of Dreams knew that wishes are sometimes best left ungranted, and he did not need to ask. Vasily awoke in the forest.
What? How?
And one night in early spring, when the crescent moon hung sharp and white in the sky, he ran through the woods in the shape of a wolf. He recognized her scent from far across the wood. The hunt lasted for hours, until at the end, his teeth closed gently on her neck, not breaking the skin. And she lay still.
Vasily!
And then, flickering and shifting from wolf shape to man shape, they celebrated their union. And the people came from hundreds of leagues around for the wedding, and they lived happily together until death parted them.
And that's it, huh?
Yes, that's the story.
It's kind of sexist.
It's not sexist at all. It's the custom of the people. Or it was, before we came here.
So how did the Dream King's book get into the old peddler woman's sack in the first place?
The Dream King tells me his secrets? It just was, that's all.
There isn't any Dream King. Just another made-up person and another dumb story. I know what this story is about. My parents put you up to this, didn't they? It's about Christopher, isn't it? It's about my boyfriend.
Why would it be about your boyfriend?
Because he's not one of the people. He's one of them. Jesus, you're so transparent, Grandpa. Look, we don't live in the forest anymore. This is New Jersey, not Novaya Zemlya. And I can go out with whoever I want to.
It was a true story.
True? Give me a break.
It's a story of the people. Don't you want to know where you come from? Who you are?
Not really. It's sexist, it's insular, and the moral is that people are happy with the people. Big surprise. I knew I should have watched TV. At least that doesn't try to pretend that we're still living 500 years ago.
But it wasn't about your boyfriend. It wasn't really even about the people. It was about what he saw when he looked at the sleeping woman. Why he turned his back on her. It was about dreams. My fault. I thought you'd want to hear the story. You watch your television. Your parents will be home soon.
Good night, Grandpa.
I wish you could have known your grandmother. She was an amazing woman. She knew the value of things. But she never let me forget that she had beaten me to the deer.
Grandfather?
Good night.
The Gobi Desert, Anno Domini, 1273. A sense of mounting panic rises in Marco's chest. A low wind has risen, and the sand stings even through the leggings. 1,000 tiny knives, he thinks. He is 17, tall, with light brown hair much too long. There's something innocent in his eyes. His clothes are faded and travel-stained. Once they were the finest a Venetian merchant could buy, but since then he has borrowed and bought burnouses and cloaks and more to replace them. Now he looks like a patchwork man. All around him stretches the sand of the Gobi Desert.
The voices. They must just be across the next dune.
The caravan. His father, his uncle. He heard them calling him.
I'm here. I'm here. I'm...
Nothing.
The Sandman, Act 2, Episode 19, Soft Places.
The sand is soft beneath his feet. He stumbles and slides down a dune, hands awkwardly grabbing at the fine rock powder, finding no grip. He truly panics now. His mouth opens and he calls out, his voice rasping on the desert wind.
Hello?
Sand enters his mouth. He carries a skin, maybe two-thirds full of brackish water. Enough for perhaps 2 days, if he is prudent. It occurs to him then that the voices he heard may have been no more than illusions brought about by thirst and hunger. The wind rises. The sky turns the livid color of an old bruise. The world is sand, from desert floor to sky. Marco covers his face with his robe, breathes in tiny, shallow bursts, crouched against the side of the dune. He hears nothing but the hiss of sand, tastes nothing but sand. His nostrils cake with sand. The corners of his eyes clog in the darkness. In the nothing world of pain and noise, he ponders his own death. And if it is to end here, well, he has traveled further than most, aye, and at a younger age. But there are such cities still to see. The storm seems to go on for 1,000 years. Then warmth and silence and sleep. The storm is over. Marco stands, pushing himself up with his arms. Sand falls from him. He throws back the robe covering his head and knuckles the sand from the corner of his eyes, remembering as he does so a tale his mother told him in the Venice of his childhood.
There's a magic man as comes to you when it's time for you to sleep. He's tall and pale, and his clothes are every colour of the rainbow. He carries a bag of magic sand by his side. You can't see him, Marco, but he can see you. He throws the magic sand into your eyes, and that's what sends you off to dreamland. That's the sand you find in your eyes when you wake.
He brushes the sand from his clothes, patterns. He almost grasps the patterns. And then he shakes the last of the sand from his cloak, and the patterns have gone. It is silent. There are no winds, no storms. The sand is smooth as the sky. He walks down a minor incline. It's evening, and the sun is going down slowly. Long shadows are being cast. The landscape has changed now, re-sculpted by the wind. Marco stumbles down in the chill of waking, leaves scumbled footprints in his wake. He can see where he's been. There is nothing to indicate his future path, and he hesitates. The music echoes in snatches across the silent sand. Is it in his head or out of it? He cannot tell.
No. It must be the thirst.
100 different voices echo. Words blur. The water is sour in his mouth.
Any view of any view is not strange. Is false.
And then through the babble he hears it. A voice, deep, calling his name.
Marco! Oh! Marco!
Father? Wait! Father! I'm coming! Father?
Marco, puzzled, is not looking at his father. This is a man perhaps in his late 40s, bearded and not badly dressed at all. He seems cheerful, hale and hearty.
I am not your father, laddie.
Oh.
But speak. Who are you? And where are you bound in this godforsaken waste?
I was looking for my father, my uncle, their caravan. We got separated somehow. But how did you come to the desert? Where are your people?
I have no people. As to how I got here, well, do you know, I'm not sure. I was in a prison cell in Genoa, and everything went so strange. I called Marco.
That's my name.
He's much older than you. My cellmate, Marco Millions. That's what they call him. Messiah... Marco... Millions. Oh, it's getting chilly. So, laddie, where is this place?
This is the desert of Lop.
No, don't say anything else. I have it! I forget nothing. Listen to this. The desert of Lop. Birds and beasts, there are none in this desert, because they find nothing to eat. But I assure you, a very strange thing is found here, which I shall relate to you. The truth is this. When a man is riding by night through this desert, and some things happen to make him loiter or lose touch with his companions, by dropping asleep or for some other reason, and afterwards he wants to rejoin them, then he hears spirits talking and will suppose them to be his companions. Sometimes, indeed, they even hail him by name. Often these voices make him stray from the path so that he never finds it again. And in this way, many travelers have strayed and perished.
As night gathers, the desert air cools, and Rusticello declaims, Marco fancies his surroundings have taken on a strange, gloomy quality, with skulls, rib cages, and other bones half buried in the sand. His mind's eye conjures a lone traveler kneeling, terrified, in the sand, surrounded by hostile spirit shapes, some mounted, some in armor, some wearing turbans, under a huge crescent moon in the sky.
Sometimes in the night they are conscious of the noise, like the clatter of a great cavalcade of riders away from the road. And believing that these are of their own company, they go where they hear the noise. And when day breaks, find they are victims of an illusion and in an awkward plight. And there are some who, in crossing this desert, have seen a host of men coming towards them, and suspecting that they were robbers, have taken flight. So, having left the beaten track and not knowing how to return to it, they have gone hopelessly astray. Even by daylight, men hear these spirits' voices. Often you fancy you can hear the strains of many musical instruments, especially the sound of drums and the clash of arms. For this reason, travelers make a point of keeping close together. Before they go to sleep at night, they set up a sign pointing in the direction they have to travel, and they fasten little bells all around their beasts so that they may prevent them from straying from the path. Thus it is that the desert is crossed. There! Word for word! Or near as, damn it.
What was that?
It's from the account of the travels of my cellmate, as rendered by me, Rusticello of Pisa. It's a description of the world.
I don't understand.
He's seen it all, you see. Marco Polo. He's seen the world. I just write it down.
Marco Polo? That's me.
Of course. I should have known. I'm dreaming. That's what's happening, young Marco. I'm dreaming.
So, I'm dreaming too?
Of course not. You're just something in my dream.
Oh, I don't feel like something in a dream.
Look, we can't both be dreaming, so I'm afraid it's definitely you. Well, not to worry. Dreams shouldn't worry. Let's go and find somewhere comfortable to wait until we wake. It's so rare to realize that you're dreaming when you are. Maybe we'll meet some women. Take it from me, lad. The worst thing about being in prison is having to smuggle in Genoese whores. Now, let's find some company.
Listen, old man. This is the desert of Lop. It's the most deserted spot on God's earth. We aren't going to find any company here. I have to find my father. I have to find the caravan.
No, you listen. You went through the desert of Lop on your way to Shangtu, what, 20, 30 years ago now? You've no reason to worry. What am I doing? I'm arguing with a dream.
Or I am. Oh, it's getting cold.
Ah, well, there's a fire over there. Let's go and sit down.
A fire? It must be my father's caravan. You'll see.
Marco and Rusticello walk towards a thin skein of smoke which rises from a distant dune. The red glow of a fire becomes visible, and lit by it, a large man, wearing the clothes of a much later century, a suit, cloak, and wide-brimmed hat, sitting on a folding chair by the fire.
Hola! Come and sit down, friends. Come and warm yourselves.
As they grow nearer, they see that he sports a walrus moustache and wears a monocle. Beside him on the ground rests a sword stick and a Gladstone bag.
See? What did I tell you? It's a dream. Hail, stranger!
Whom?
Come and warm yourself up. It can get cold here in the soft places.
Excuse me, sir. My father and my uncle, Niccolo and Maffeo Polo, they are with a caravan. They are traders, merchants. Have you seen them?
I haven't seen anyone. I came out to the soft places to think, to get away from myself.
Messire, have you wine?
Wine? A ruby red Beaujolais, a sweet topaz-colored tokay? What a wonderful idea. Indeed, we will drink wine, and you will tell me your stories, and perhaps other travelers, equally as congenial, will arrive, and we will entertain them too.
You really have wine?
Sir, what kind of a traveler would I be without wine? Let me see. Stub of a train ticket, a chalk, a brown paper bag. See what happens when you leave and go somewhere else. A packet of jelly babies. Ah, wine and tankards. Tankard, young man?
Thank you.
And you, Miss Anne?
Much obliged.
Sir, forgive me for asking, but are you a dream?
Oh, yes. See? So, my friend, we have the wine. When do we get female company? I ache for the joys of love.
Oh, bless my soul, no. I'm trying to get away from all that.
Good wine.
The only reason I'm out here is because they keep coming for walks in me. Long ones, gazing into each other's eyes, whispering sweet and, to be frank, rather embarrassing nothings. So I've taken an evening off.
I'm sorry?
My lord and his new woman. I've got nothing against women or love, but, well, it's embarrassing. Enough of that. So, who are you, lad? What's your story?
My name is Marco Polo.
Ah, you know, somehow I thought it might be.
When I was very young, my father and my uncle were traveling in Constantinople. As wars broke out behind them, they were forced to continue on to the east into uncharted territory. Eventually, they reached the court of the great king, Kublai Khan himself, in far Cathay. Now, while the Khan himself was a heathen and an idolater, he looked kindly upon the Christian faith. My father wished to convert the Khan to the true faith, and thus convert all his empire, which extends from the lands of night in the north to the uttermost islands of the east. Imagine how many would be drawn into the faith at a stroke. What that would do to the world. But the Khan has idolater priests who work miracles for him. They ensure that it is always summer above his palace, though it rains and storms nearby. They cause his food and wine to fly into his hand so never a drop is spilled and never a man touches them. Look at them, said the Khan to my father. They have power even I fear. So this I say, go back to your Pope and tell him to send me 100 Christian miracle workers who will show my priests that your Christ can work miracles as great as those of their Gautama Buddha.
Good gracious. So what happened?
Well, they came back. I was 15. I can't have been more than 4 when they left.
Friend, have you more wine?
But of course.
But the Pope was dead, and no new Pope was chosen. They waited for 2 years for a Pope. Then, when Gregory was elected, he pointed out he didn't have 100 miracle workers. He didn't even have 1.
There's a terribly nice Franciscan in 17th century Assisi who can fly. IQ of 60, and perhaps a little too heavily into self-mutilation, but he can honestly fly. St. Joseph of Copertino. Bit after your time. Sorry. Pray, continue.
Eventually, when I was 16, we set off from Venice with 2 elderly Dominican priests.
Could they do miracles?
Well, not so you'd notice. One of them had a little thing he did with a cup and some balls, but it wasn't very impressive. They both dropped out before we reached Syria. They got scared. We went on. We've been traveling for almost 2 years now, and Kublai Khan himself waits on the other side of this desert. I have seen such cities.
Yes, that was your genius, being able to describe cities. Not just the land or the trade, but the soul of the city. What made it uniquely itself. Kublai Khan stayed in his summer palace in summer, and his winter palace in winter, like a spider edging from one side of the web to another. And you went out to all the cities in his empire and came home and described them to him. I know the story, you see. I'm writing it all down for you, so it'll be remembered.
Sir, I'm hungry. Have you got any food?
Food. Let's see what we can manage. Well, there are jelly babies. A bit sticky, but quite palatable. And
oh, good Lord! Sandwiches! I do believe it. Yes, cheese and pickle. Here you are.
Look, riders.
Where?
On the horizon. A dust cloud. I can see banners.
Is that dust? It's as if the riders themselves are made of smoke.
So many of them.
Great Lord, may we speak to you?
Oh, I don't see why not.
We seek the true world. Some of us have been searching for many thousands of years. But the true world is no closer. We ride and we ride.
I fear your business is not with me, friend, but with my master.
Sir, if we ever return to the Hardlands, there are some amongst us who believe that we would die of old age, crumbling to dust like the men in the tales. Others claim that we would return to the world on the day we left it and live out the span of our lives, and all the time we spent in this place would fade and vanish. Like a dawn dream on waking that colors the day but cannot be touched or remembered. Which would it be, sir? Which would it be?
I wish I knew.
Aye. So do we, Lord. Come. Let us ride.
Are they dreams too?
Oh, yes. After their fashion, but... then we are all dreams in our fashion?
I'm not.
Sir, what is this place?
Here? I thought I told you that already. You're in one of the soft places. There were more of them in the olden days. I remember when I was just a young vicinity, there were soft places everywhere. Well, not everywhere, but they were a sight more common than now. Even in your time, they were more common than they are today. Sometimes I think that their loss is your fault.
My fault?
Yours, Huen Tsang, Ibn Battuta's, the lot of you. The explorers, and the ones who came after you, who froze the world into rigid patterns.
You're talking as if we're dead, man. Dead and crumbled to dust.
That's what you are. To me, your history, both of you, 700 years gone. Time at the edge of the dreaming is softer than elsewhere, and here in the soft places it loops and whirls on itself. In the soft places where the border between dreams and reality is eroded or has not yet formed, time. It's like throwing a stone into a pool. It casts ripples. That's where we are. Here. In the soft places, where the geographies of dream intrude upon the real. Could I have your tankards, please?
Of course. Thank you for the refreshment.
Would you pass my Gladstone bag, dear sir?
This? Here.
Thank you.
Here, my tankard too.
There aren't many left in my time. This place is still soft. That's how come we can all be here together. In my day, that's 1992, this part of the desert is known as Taklamakan. That's Turkic for, if you go in, you won't come out again. Good, eh?
this is the soft place?
Not the only one. There's a few thousand square miles of central Australia, a couple of Pacific islands, a field in Ireland, an occasional mountain in Arizona.
An occasional mountain?
It's not a very big mountain, but it's only there occasionally. Now, if you just hold open the bag, I'll put the chair in.
That's a very interesting bag.
It's useful. There. Oh, I'm sorry, I almost forgot to take the fire.
The fire? In your bag?
Oh, yes. Don't worry, there's plenty of room.
I have had far too much to drink.
Sir, are there really such soft places?
Have you ever heard of Fiddler's Green, Marco? The paradise on earth that some say all sailors dream of finding?
No.
Pity. Good meeting you, gentlemen. Oh, and that's Fiddler's Green, like the colour. Perhaps you could mention it in one of your stories, Messiah Rusticello.
Yes, of course.
Messiah Rusticello? Messiah Polo?
Goodbye.
Hey! Thanks for the wine.
What a nice man. I wonder where he went.
He went wherever old dreams go, I'd imagine. Off to dreamland. You all join him soon, and you can find out then. I'll wake up, and you'll be gone where dreams go.
I'm not a dream.
Oh, you're a dream, all right. Only question is, whose? I think you're mine. But maybe I'm wrong.
Eh?
Hey, boy. Who's dreaming you?
For the last time, nobody's dream... Messiah Rusticello? Messiah Rusticello!
And Marco is alone again.
Sir?
Hearing a sound, Marco turns to find a tall, thin stranger clad entirely in black, with a white face and a shock of black hair, standing behind him.
Sir, I am lost here. I met people, but they've all gone now. Can you help? Are you a dream as well?
Morpheus, the Lord of Dreams, is at this point not entirely in control of his own situation. He has recently escaped a long imprisonment and looks exhausted and unkempt. His clothes are dusty and worn.
Yes. Yes, I am Dream.
Dream?
I fear, however, that I am in no position to help you. I have just freed myself from captivity. I have just chastised my captor, and I am so weak. I have been away so long, I must return to my castle.
I have some water left. Do you need water?
I thank you.
Sir, are you the lord of this place?
Indeed.
I met a man in this place who spoke of a land called Fiddler's Green. He said you were in love, that you went walking all the time with your woman.
Did he say who this woman was?
I don't remember. I'm sorry.
It is not important. It has happened already, or it is still to come. And forewarned is seldom forearmed. Not even in the shifting zones.
The man I mentioned, he said this was called a soft place?
Yes, that is a valid name. The soft places of the world, the shifting places, the... Oh, my head.
You look terrible. White as the man in the moon. Are you always so pale?
That depends on who's watching.
Sorry?
It's no matter. I thank you for your order, young man. I will be on my way.
Sir? Can you tell me how to get back? How to return to my father, to his caravan, to the desert of Lop?
No.
But, sir!
You come in. You do not go out again.
But they said! They said I'd get out! The fat man and the other man, Rusticello! They said I'd get out! They said I'd go home!
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be trapped here forever.
I can appreciate that. Rusticello, the fantasist. You're Marco Polo.
Yes.
I see. Yes, you are trapped. I know how that feels. But you gave me water, and I am not ungrateful. However, I am very weak, and if I help you, I may not be able to help myself. Marco?
Yes?
Yes. I'll send you back. You will even see your home again. You will have to go the long way, though, and you do not know how fortunate you are.
I do.
No, you don't. Hold out your hand.
As the sand falls into his hand, Marco hears the rumble of distant thunder. Storms are coming, he thinks, as if from a long way off. He finds himself able to see each falling grain of sand, distinct and unique, and he knows then that he is really dreaming. There are truly patterns. It is a revelation of a kind. Dreams and sand and stories. Deserts and cities and time. The grains fall slowly, tumbling down from the Dream King's pale fingers into his own travel-stained hand. The patterns they formed as they fell illuminate his mind, a landscape strobed by flashes of distant lightning. I'll never forget this, he thinks triumphantly. I'll never forget what I've learned here. But his world goes dark and soft and nowhere. And Marco plunges down with it. He hears the jingling of little bells. A horse, yes. Then strong hands pulling him out of the sand.
Marco! We thought we'd lost you for good. Are you all right, laddie? Christ wounds, you can't have been more than 100 feet from us all the time.
I came back.
You had us worried. We heard such strange things last night, boy. It seemed like a horde of men was riding past, although we saw nothing. Dreams and illusions breed in this damn place. Come, back to camp.
Father?
Yes?
I have to tell you about the patterns.
Patterns?
I'm sorry. Nothing. A dream. I had a dream. I don't know. It's gone now. I don't remember.
Well, come and eat. We set off again in an hour. In future, you must ignore the illusions. They're no more than dreams and of as little importance as that. They nearly killed you, Marco. Do you understand me?
Yes, Father.
Thus it is that the desert is crossed. It's early afternoon in Hippolyta Hall's apartment. Story time for her toddler, Daniel.
And then the baby bear said, "Someone's been sleeping in my bed, and she's still there." And Goldilocks? Well, she woke up and she jumped out of the window and didn't stop running until she got home. And that is the end of the story. There.
Eerie!
Oh, did you like that, Daniel? Did you like it? Now, you know what's going to happen now. You got it, baby cakes. Time for your nap. Where is Daniel's num-num? Oh, here it is. Now you have a lovely, lovely nap. Dream good dreams, and Mama will come and get you when you wake up. Okay, baby?
The Sandman, Act 2, Episode 20, The Parliament of Rooks.
Soon, I am going to start climbing the wall.
Hi, this is Carla.
Hi, Carla. It's me, Lyda.
Hey. And how's my little cutie Woody?
Daniel. Oh, he's fine. I just put him down for his nap.
And Mom?
Me? I am going stir crazy, and I have joined the ranks of the walking brain dead. But otherwise, I am just...
Baby Daniel is pretty well conditioned to his afternoon nap these days. They have settled well into the new apartment. Lyta is trying to rebuild her life after a 2-year hiatus spent in the realm of dreams, where Daniel was conceived with Lyta's late husband, Hector Hall. Freed from the dream by Morpheus of the Endless, Lyta was able to return to the waking world and rebuild her life. But she has paid a steep price to get her life back. It wasn't just the loss of her beloved Hector. One day, she has been told, she will have to give up her child. Born in dreams, Daniel belongs only in part to this world. He has been claimed by Morpheus. Daniel's freshly painted nursery wall sports a mural featuring the owl and the pussycat. Their pea-green boat sails towards an island on which grows a clump of trees. Along the horizon, an alphabet undulates across a painted sky, a sun at one end and a moon and stars at the other. As Daniel's eyes trace the path of the letters, they begin to close. Daniel is asleep.
He figures out how to get out of his
crib. Daniel is already out of his crib. Or rather, while he sleeps, his dream self stands on the floor of the nursery, absent-mindedly steadying himself by keeping one hand on the cot. Happily exploring, he lurches off towards the side of the painted mural. The ABC letters above his head reach Z, but instead of being cut off where the wall ends, continue into a series of symbols and runes unknown to any human alphabet. Steadier on his feet as he moves onward, the carpet under Daniel's feet turns to patchy grass and dirt, and he enters the dreaming. There is something green and scaly poking out from behind a rock. Daniel tries to pick it up. It's the tail of a large green gargoyle named Gregory. Gregory bends his huge head down to inspect the child. Daniel, unafraid, pats his nose.
Ducky!
The sky is a strange grey colour. There's a low mist, and the ground is rocky. Toddling up a slope, Daniel stumbles and uses his hand to steady himself. Gregory, concerned, decides to follow. The hill levels out at a cemetery, where old gravestones stand at drunken angles, grass and weeds between them. Matthew the Raven, big and black, perches on a moss and lichen-covered monument near a flight of stone steps leading further up.
Hi, kid. You come for a secret, too? What's your name, huh?
Bertie!
Bertie. Weird name. You mean me. Yeah, I'm Matthew, a raven at your service. Oh, hey, Gregory, how's it hanging? Yeah? Well, you should try being a bird sometime. Right. Okay, up the steps, kiddo. Come on, one at a time.
Matthew, who's your friend?
Huh? Eve, what are you doing away from the cave?
Matthew, really?
Eve is the widow of Adam, the mother of Cain and Abel, and a long-term resident of the Dreaming. Today she is tall and dark and young. She wears a long wraparound robe and descends to where the toddler is trying to negotiate the steps.
Is there any rule that says I always have to dwell in nightmares?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you always have, as long as we've been together. And rules? Hey, this place is full of more rules than you can shake a stick at. Sometimes I think he makes them up as he goes along.
No, he made them a very long time ago. It's part of his nature, making rules. Up you come, child. I'll carry you up the steps. You can see the House of Secrets. Let's see if Abel is in.
Bertie!
What is he? I thought the kid was a dream at first, but he doesn't really talk.
No, he's a human child.
Yeah? So, what's his story?
His name is Daniel. Won't you all come in? This is indeed an honor. Through here, please.
The House of Secrets is Abel's abode in the Dreaming. The living room has a stuffed moose head on the wall, a stuffed crocodile hanging from the ceiling, and cobwebs all over. The furniture is antique and in terrible repair. Junk is everywhere. Boxes and crystal balls and skulls and Dresden figurines and dead plants and more boxes. There are tongs and thumbscrews and books and cups. An Iron Maiden stands in one corner.
It's a little messy, but I call it home. Do take a seat, Eve.
Thank you. Come. Sit on my lap, Daniel.
Eve sits down on a dusty old sofa with Daniel in her arms. Matthew perches on the mantelpiece while Gregory curls his huge green bulk up in a corner.
Would anybody care for refreshments?
That would be very nice. Thank you. Tea, please, with lemon. Oh, you want to get down, little man?
I don't drink tea, but I'll take a saucer of water. And if you got anything for me to eat, hey, I wouldn't say no.
There may be a dead rat or two left downstairs. We've got something nasty in the basement, but he always kills more than he can eat. Eyes too big for his whatever.
Yeah, a rat would be great with the eyes in for preference.
I'll see what we can do.
Little Goldie, the big-footed baby gargoyle, stands by the side of the fireplace. Daniel, crawling across the floor, makes a beeline for him.
Doggy, me?
His name's Goldie, Daniel. He's a baby gargoyle.
Goldie!
It's weird being a raven. I mean, you really are a raven when you're a raven. When he gave me the option of staying with you as a big black bird or moving on, I suppose I figured I'd be a man in a raven's body. Nope, don't work like that. I am a raven, one of the Corvidae family. Hell, I suppose it could have been worse. I could have been a crow. I mean, they're dumb as shit and they lie a lot.
You can choose your friends, my love. You can't choose your family. Here, sit on my lap and I'll scratch your head.
Matthew. Once a human government agent named Matthew Cable is now Eve's companion. He hops into her lap.
Jackdaws are okay, though. And rooks are just weird. Oh, that is nice, Eve. Magpies are cool. I mean, they've got their own counting rhyme. You ever hear it? One for sorrow, two for joy.
Three for a girl, four for a boy. Five for silver, six for gold.
And seven for a secret, never to be told. It's quite true, you know. Here you are, a rat. It's a bit rotten, I'm afraid.
No problem. They taste better that way. Gives them some flavor. Mm.
A cup of tea.
Thank you, Abel. I assume you served Gregory first because I'm not 9 feet tall and I don't weigh a ton.
Oh, sorry.
I was impressed by his extended pinky, but now he's eating his cup and saucer.
Oh, bad gargoyle.
Hey, Abel. Terrific rat.
Oh, thank you. So Matthew, how's Lord Morpheus?
I'm not sure. I mean, they've been pretty inseparable for the last few weeks. I've hardly seen him. Either they're in his quarters or going for long walks, hand in hand.
Oh, dear.
How do you mean?
She's really not his type, is she?
I didn't think he had a type.
Why, bless my boots and chin whiskers.
Abel's brother has been hiding overhead all this time. Perched on the stuffed crocodile.
Kane!
Do my eyes deceive me? Could it be? Is my beloved brother actually having a party without me? Oh, be still, my trembling heart.
No, not at all. We were just saying how nice it would be if you were here.
You're not even a good liar, Barrel Belly.
Bang!
Who's the brattling?
His name's Daniel, Kane. A human child. Off limits. He's with me.
A human child? Really? Well. Three old storytellers have found themselves an audience. Will wonders never cease?
Me!
So here we are, all three of us. Just like the old days. And we've even got an audience. Let's tell stories.
Oh, I've stopped telling stories.
No one stops telling stories. It's in the blood. Storytellers who don't tell stories aren't anything. They're nothing at all.
No trouble, please, Kane. No trouble.
Lay off, Kane. Anyway, I came here for a secret.
A raven is not a small bird, but Kane is possessed of inhuman strength. He has Matthew by the neck.
Oh, you did you, birdie? But can you keep a secret? Are you sure you wouldn't prefer a mystery? I've got a mystery that'll raise the feathers on the back of your little oh-so-twistable neck.
Kane, let Matthew go.
You piss me off, Kane. And you sound just like Vincent Price.
That bargain basement vaudevillian, he sounds nothing like me. Ooh, you wound me deeply, Matthew. And you stink of rotten rat.
Yeah, and you stink of old ham. Okay. A mystery. But better be good.
You mentioned rooks earlier. Well, let me give you a mystery of rooks.
As Cain tells the story, he conjures the image of an open stretch of winter countryside where the bare trees are studded with black knots of interlocked twigs, the nests of rooks.
Rook, Corvus frugilagus, also a word meaning to cheat or steal, also a piece in chess. Rooks are the most social of the corvidae. They build nests in rookeries, an obsolete name, incidentally, for a ghetto of thieves and whores, with many hundreds of birds to a tree. They have enough of a language that even humans can tell the difference between their danger calls and their all-clear calls. They can imitate human speech. But there's something else. The mystery. Among the individual corvids, you can speak of a crow, a magpie, and a raven. The mystery is from where we derive the collective noun we use for these birds, like a murder of crows, a tidings of magpies, an unkindness of ravens. A parliament of rooks. You'll get a field, empty. Suddenly the sky is black with birds, and they fall like a ragged black rain onto the field, covering it almost completely. In the center of the field, there's an empty space, and in the middle of that space sits one lone rook. It caws and calls and caws some more. 10,000 little eyes stare at it, unflinching. Sometimes they call out, as if they're asking questions. It's like a parliament. It's like a trial. The lone rook continues to call, and the others wait. This can go on for hours, from dawn till near dusk.
Yeah? Then what happens?
One of two things. On some signal, which human observers have been unable to identify, either the birds take wing as one, leaving the lone rook alone in the field, or again, as one, they fall on the bird and peck it to death. That's what happens.
Why?
It's a mystery, isn't it?
Huh.
Now that's something I've never done, eh, Brother Gullyguts?
Huh?
Pecked you to death?
Huh?
There. That was mine. Now, who's next? You, meat boy? No, he's useless for now. It'll have to be you, mother.
I'm not your mother, Cain.
You're everybody's mother.
That's a matter of opinion. But I don't tell stories. Not anymore.
Not even to little children? Little human children? A little son of Adam?
Daniel is now firm friends with Goldie.
Daddy! Meep, 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 meep!
I don't have any stories for Daniel.
Everybody has one story.
Yes. Yes, they do. Okay. Adam had three wives.
Huh? Three?
Sure. It's not a story they tell much anymore, Matthew. It's an old story. It begins with Adam. They say he was hermaphrodite, an androgyne giant, back in the beginning, in the dawn. Male and female created he them, and he called their name Adam. Four arms, four legs, two heads, two sets of sexual organs joined back to back.
Like, conjoined twins.
Yes, Matthew. And God divided Adam into two beings, one male, one female, Adam and Lilith. Lilith was Adam's first wife. She was powerful and intelligent. She was, after all, him. A female him. During sex, she insisted on climbing on top. A position of equality. Superiority, perhaps. That was, perhaps, the final straw. Lilith was expelled from Eden, and she planted her own garden. They say she copulated with demons or with the sons of God. She had many children. Adam was left alone. It was then that God created the second wife. Oh, she never had a name, poor thing. God created her for Adam out of nothingness. Bones first, then internal organs, then flesh, muscle, sinew, fat, bile, eyes, snot, skin, hair, breath. Adam watched as she was put together, layer by layer. It wasn't a pretty sight. Not until she was finished, when she took her first breath. Adam couldn't bear to go near her. He wouldn't touch her. He saw her full of secretions and blood. That's what the Midrash states.
The Midrash?
Oh, that's an ancient Judaic text. Interpreting the Old Testament.
Nobody asked you, Moonface.
Bodies are strange. Some people have real problems with the stuff that goes on inside them. You find out that inside someone you know, there's just mucus and meat and slime and bone. They menstruate, salivate, defecate, and cry. You know, sometimes it can just kill the romance. You know that?
Jesus. So what happened to her?
Opinions differ. Most say God destroyed her. A few have claimed that she was permitted to leave the garden alone. Then it was that God put Adam to sleep, took a rib from his side, and from it created Eve. Only when she was complete did Adam wake.
Oh.
He saw Eve, finished and perfect, and took her to wife. And they ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and knowing good from evil, they were no longer in paradise.
It's raining hard in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve are leaving. They're wet. She looks to be about 4 months pregnant. They wear leaves around their waists, and they are soaked. Adam has put his arm around Eve's shoulders.
In Genesis, it states that God expelled them because he was scared. Scared that, having disobeyed him once, they'd disobey him again. And they'd eat of the tree of life and live forever, like gods. Endless.
Daddy!
Adam and Eve lived together until death parted them. Some there are that say this is true history, and that there really was an earthly paradise. Others claim the tale is merely a metaphor for the rise of consciousness, the bittersweet fruit of wisdom. But this is true. Adam had three wives.
Adam's three wives appear in Eve's vision. The first, Lilith, floats above the ground. Her hair blows around her head. She's smiling, beckoning to them. Half-seen ghosts and forms swarm around her.
And Lilith gave birth to the Lilim, the children of Lilith, who have haunted the nights of the sons of Adam ever since, mother to so many.